Tonight on Arena, we hear about FitzHenry, Kirkcudbright's Anglo-Irish theatrical horse, and new albums from Garbage Marina and Slater Kinney up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Kirkcudbright takes on iconic Frank O'Connor short story Guests of the Nation, so reads the headline. And it's certainly a tantalising prospect given the reputation of that theatre company for daring site-specific work and the renown of the Frank O'Connor story first published in 1931. The guests in the story are, of course, English soldiers held hostage by Irish Republican Army volunteers during the War of Independence. A bond develops between the two sets of soldiers, complicating matters when the Irishmen get orders to execute the prisoners. The full production of Guests of the Nation is scheduled for 2022, but in the meantime, Kirkcudbright are taking FitzHenry, a pantomime Anglo-Irish horse, for a walk around Cork City this month in a work in progress called Where is the Horse? Joining me this evening to try to answer that question for me are Pat Kiernan, director, composer Mel Mercier, and writer Kevin Barry. To start with you, Pat, this is a work in development, and you're working towards this, I think, what's going to be a big street production next year. But why did you choose that Frank O'Connor story, first of all, Guests of a Nation?
Well, I suppose, in general, I suppose, over the last number of years, there's this kind of decade of centenaries, so I think there was a lot of ideas, thoughts about, you know, the 100 years ago and the Irish-English situation. And I think that Maura Keefe was working with us. We kind of spoke about that story. And I think that as a piece, it's such a kind of a dense and full expression of a lot of stuff that was going on at that time. So the closer we kind of looked at it, we felt that it could be something that we could launch off. I suppose that Frank O'Connor is kind of iconic as well, and I suppose always with Kirkcudbright as well. I suppose you kind of feel that it's important for us to engage with where we are from as well, and both physically in terms of making the work and in terms of content, that we can have a relationship with our audience in something that exists already, rather than sometimes bringing kind of work that people may be aware of, may not be aware of, to them. Yeah.
So Kevin Barry then, writer Kevin Barry. Kevin, I presume Pat came to you with a remit that included the words Guest of the Nation and sent you in the direction of that story. Where did that story lie in your own imagination? I presume, like many of us, you came across it in secondary school.
Yeah, like I was trying to think when the lads got in touch with me kind of at the end of last year. And I suppose everyone read kind of my first confession and things like that in secondary for the intercert of the Frank O'Connor things. I had a period in my kind of 20s when I was living in Cork City where I read a lot of kind of Frank O'Connor, Sean O'Fallon, kind of getting the books out of the Grand Parade Library and sort of, I'd say that's when I first read Guests of the Nation as a story. And like Pat was saying there, it's there's so much in it, you know. It's kind of got war and peace and life and death and everything else. It's a great thing to launch off, you know. There's so much you can explore in terms of the themes and the elements that come out of the story, and then that it suggests an awful lot of different ways you could approach it, you know.
But I think the approach at the moment is very much not in terms of text. It's something else is sparking off these initial stages of development, Kevin.
Yeah, like when I reread the story, Erin Deer got it out, one of the things that really struck me is this great kind of collegiate kind of atmosphere that develops between the English prisoners and the Irish soldiers, which is very, very true to life and everyone's experience. I think Irish and English people tend to get on very well. But there's also a kind of a trickiness to the relationship, a kind of a darker side to it as well. And I was... the image came to my mind of a pantomime horse, of a theatrical two-person horse, because it's such a kind of it's an uneasy alliance, you know. It's a kind of an awkward dance, and it's also, of course, the eternal question, who's going to be the backside of the horse tonight? So it seemed to be a kind of a useful way of looking at the whole relationship between Ireland and England.
Yeah, I guess who is in the rump part of the horse is one question. And of course, who's driving the horse? Is it the rump or is it the front part? That's another question that must be part of what you're considering. But Mel Mercier then, as a composer, quite often, Mel, I'm guessing, as a composer, you're brought in more often than not at a late enough stage in the development of a theatre project or a film project or whatever it is you might be working on, and you're told, will you give us some music for this scene, or will you present, give us something that might evoke this kind of atmosphere? But you're right in at the very beginning of the developmental process here. How important was that for you, Mel?
Yeah, I mean, that's very important for me, and you're right. You know, theatre, as we know, is interdisciplinary, and the lines between those disciplines can be quite clearly drawn at times. But it's also in part as well quite hierarchical. And I think one of the things that Pat has done is that he's kind of broken down that hierarchy in his invitation to myself and Kevin. And in fact, he's invited us to kind of trespass on each other's disciplines. So at this point in time, I'm not actually thinking musically at all about it, which is wonderful for me, to be perfectly honest, because I feel I'm in it at the point of its kind of conception. So now is a kind of time for ideas and to be invited into that kind of, you know, play with imagination. And so it feels like we're in, the three of us, like a trio, we're in this kind of liminal creative time, which is, of course, full of uncertainty and questions and experimentation. So it's a time like this where you fret a little when you go on the radio a year in advance, because you're afraid you might be asked what it's about.
And you're afraid you might be asked.
What I say to that is that it's good. It's actually it's good to hang out as long as we can on the edge, because we'll move to the center eventually. And there's time enough to be fixing things. But at the moment, we're trying to hold ourselves in that place of exploration and uncertainty and potential.
I just missed what you said there, Mel. You said you were afraid on radio that you might be asked what?
That you might be asked what it's all about.
All right, OK. I don't know. I wouldn't do that to you. Pat, what is it all about, this project?
This time next year, we'll be able to tell you.
No, I was interested in something, though, that Kevin said there in terms of the collegiality that builds up, I suppose, between the lowly Irish volunteers and the British squaddies in the Frank O'Connor story. I suppose you're picking up on that collegiality here, but you do know that... Guess the Nation doesn't end too well after all of that collegiality. How will you keep things on an even keel if people are, as Mel Mercier says, trespassing on each other's disciplines at the moment?
I mean, I suppose often I think that in terms of theatre, it's image and ideas as much as text. And I think that certainly, I mean, as Mel was saying, is that, you know, I think what's been useful about this particular exercise in terms of looking at the horse, it was a scene that had been, Kevin had written some texts late last year, early this year, which we looked at, and as he described, the one with the pantomime horse, but it was two characters who came out of it, and an English character and an Irish character. So I suppose... For me, it's really interesting sometimes as well when we're making work out in the streets or publicly, in terms of, like, it's often it can be what we see as much as what we hear or experience in terms of the world. And I think that for me, I suppose it's like seeing the three of us as theatre makers. And I think that for me, the most important stage is beginning to find a language between us, and then how we make that happen into the finished production will be, you know, as I said, you know, we start making decisions then, and maybe reversing into more specific roles at some
at that
stage.
Point, Kevin, I'm thinking too, you know, the fact that you have obviously given us screenplays in the past as well. You're used to thinking, I suppose, in this visual fashion, very different from writing a novel or a short story, where you're very much concerned with the text and the words themselves. Is this process something similar to that, where you just said, no, let's keep words out of this, let's think about image. I'll describe the images in words, but let's think purely imagistically.
Yeah, I guess so. And I guess what we're doing as well is, I mean, a lot of nattering on Zoom is what we're doing. But I mean, what we're doing is we're trying to kind of envelop ourselves in the kind of the atmosphere of the piece, and trying to see if we can use that to bring an adaptation maybe to unexpected places.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much in this story. It's almost a case, I think, of like reduction more than expansion with some of the elements of it, you know. But there's a huge amount to play with. There's so many hooks. And one of the things about reading Frank O'Connor now in 2021 is he reads very freshly, you know. It doesn't feel like an exercise in nostalgia to go back to his work. And it speaks very much, of course, to the present moment in terms of so many things going on in terms of the ever uneasy alliance, you know, between the two countries.
Mel, I'm just wondering, though, you know, you were talking about this idea of, in some ways, trespassing. And I know what you mean. What you're saying is it's nice to be able to go in and look around somebody else's shop, if you like. The sweet shop that they spend their times in as an artist, the writer there with his words or her words, the theatre director there with images and the tools of the stage. Is it hard, however, for you as a composer not kind of start presenting themselves, musical ideas, musical, just even just little melodies? Do you have to push those out at this stage to avoid setting things too quickly, too soon?
Yes, that would be my instinct, absolutely, is to keep that impulse at bay. But actually, Sean, to be honest, I mean, I know I'm talking about trespass. But in fact, really what's going on for me is that the director that's in me and the writer that's in me get an opportunity in this context to have a voice.
Yeah.
And so I think that's more what's going on. So so it's actually quite easy for me to revel in the opportunity of having the conversations that we're having. And then, as Pat says, at a certain point in time, we go back to taking on our primary responsibility of Kevin of producing the text, of Pat of directing the whole thing, and then and me of bringing the music to it, you know, finding the emotional and the kind of psychological undertow of it. But actually, the way I work as well, it's much better if I wait until the other elements start to come together, and then I begin to get a feel for the production itself rather than the written story.
Yeah, but to be involved at this stage is much more exciting. And you're using that term, trespassing, obviously in a looser sense, because you've been invited into these other places.
Exactly.
It's not as if you're saying, let me just have a little idea for you here, Kevin, that you might put in. But to have everybody there, I suppose three heads are always going to be better than one. What about the horse itself, Pat, given that it is going to appear on the streets of Cork in the coming days and weeks? Can you describe it to me visually? How big, how small? Is it two people inside? How many people are controlling it? All of those type of things.
Yeah, well, it's the designer, Elisa Galloroso, who has designed and made it, has based it on a draft horse, which is slightly bigger than your regular horse. So I think it's about 7 foot high, the head. There are two people in it. And I suppose we're looking at the kind of the what's visible in terms of the legs of the horse, keeping what Kevin had brought into it first as well. So there's kind of subtleties, we hope, yet still information there in terms of that we can see kind of black and tan colours and one of the legs and an older Irish army image in the other legs. The horse is also led by a female character who walks with it. It's not dragging it or anything. And certainly we're looking at her almost as a representation of the woman of the house in the short story, who is probably the most aware of all the elements of what's going on there. It's an image, I suppose, that in some ways is based upon the time that the story was set in, more so than today, and that it's almost this alien image that is with a purpose walking through the streets with visual information, we hope.
Sorry, say that again, Pat?
All of it.
No, just the last thing you said there, sorry.
Well, I suppose that it's like that there's visual information in the image that we feel is true to our initial findings and discussions and debates about the original story. That's true to it yet. I mean, and I suppose one of the things I suppose that was important as well is that, you know, the reason it changed from the text to the visual image was, of course, the circumstances we're in. And we were kind of determined to try to bring something that people could see. The fact that it's mobile fitted in with COVID regulations as well as that it's not a an assembled audience. So that, and it's unannounced. So it'll appear at many, many different places.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering maybe the types of places that it might appear at, given that, you know, I know you don't want to get too far down into the specifics of the story itself, but we are talking about, you know, a house as being a very important setting as the story, and the coldness of the bog as being a very important set up important place in Guests of the Nation as well. Will you be bringing it to specific places, or have you thought about that side of things?
Well, yeah, well, we certainly have thought about it. I mean, we're looking at some historical sites that might be relevant, but also I kind of want to see the horse queuing at Penny's as well. And, you know, being at the beach, you know. So it's not that lit, you know, where I think it's about the footprint it'll have on the whole city and county. It's almost like that it's a tourist, you know.
Well, listen, it certainly sounds exciting already at this point. And I'm presuming all three of you will promise me that when you come on next year and I ask you, what's this all about, that you will actually answer the question directly. Can I have agreement on that?
Absolutely. You have
I don't think I'll get anything from... Yeah, fingers crossed, that's right. But listen, great to speak with the three of you this evening. That's Pat Kiernan, Kevin Barry and Mel Mercier. And Where Is the Horse? This early stages in the development of the Cork Adurka exploration of Frank O'Connor's story, The Guest of the Nation, takes place at various surprise locations, although we've got a few hints there from Pat, didn't we, around Cork City during Cork Midsummer Fest, which runs from the 14th through to the 27th of June. And you can get full details on corkmidsummer.com.
When it comes to your oral care, you should have confidence in the tools you use. Oral-B, the number one brand recommended by dentists worldwide. The electric toothbrushes remove up to 100% more plaque compared to a manual brush. Switch to an Oral-B electric toothbrush today and get that dentist clean feeling at home. Oral-B, brush like a pro.
At Permanent TSB, we know your first home isn't always your forever home. Times change, families grow, and now you're looking for something a little more permanent. We're helping you make that move with new lower rates for second-time buyers, meaning you'll see real savings every single month. That's permanent support. Book an appointment today at permanenttsb.ie. Lending criteria, terms and conditions apply. Security and insurance is required. Warning, if you do not keep up your repayments, you may lose your home. Warning, if you do not meet the repayments on your loan, your account will go into arrears. This may affect your credit rating, which may limit your ability to access credit in the future. Permanent TSB PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
The new Dun Stores app puts better value at your fingertips, so you'll never miss out on savings. Your 10 off 50 grocery vouchers are always just a swipe away. You can also track and earn value club points and browse our latest grocery offers. And when you download it today, you'll receive a one-time 10 off 30 welcome voucher. So all you need to do is grab your phone and start saving. The new Dun Stores app, available now wherever you get your apps. Terms and conditions apply. Welcome voucher can be used on next grocery shop of €30 or more.
In the Irish Times weekend, we begin the search for the best place to live in Ireland 2021. Find out more in the magazine. From pergolas to outdoor ovens, we've five projects to transform your garden. And in sport, Jim McGuinness weighs up Donegal's chances as they take on Dublin in the Allianz League semi-final. Pick up the Irish Times in store, enjoy home delivery, or subscribe now at irishtimes.com.
He's the sales director, finance director, HR director, and looks after IT. All without a single spark flying. Meet Sean, electrician and Citroën van driver. A great van is like Sean. It can do it all. Like the Citroën Berlingo, Dispatch and Relay. All come with multiple load volume and payload options. Three front seats, steel bulkhead, twin airbags and Bluetooth as standard. The Citroën van range. Like you, they do it all. For more, see citroen.ie.
Citroën. Nissa Crowley's murder has been protected by silence for 10 years, but the Inishroon Islanders know who to blame, and now a team of filmmakers intend to uncover the truth. After the Silence, by Louise O'Neill. Described by Marion Keyes as elegant, assured, gripping and moving, it's her best book to date. When you read it, you'll understand why. After the Silence, by Louise O'Neill. In bookshops now.
Black Alley is a new anthology fiction podcast starring some of the biggest names in Irish film and television. Each episode is a standalone story which takes place in an interconnected universe of crime, eccentricity and, it has to be said, truly awful people. Included in the cast are Paul Mescal, or we now have to say BAFTA award-winning Paul Mescal. Just this week he's achieved that award, obviously. Tom Vaughan Lawler is there, Chris Whalley, and my next guests, Alex Murphy and Claire Barrett. Also with me this evening is the creator and writer of the series, Fiontán Lárnaí. And I'll start with you, Fiontán. As I said, Paul Mescal, normal people, Chris Whalley, The Young Offenders, Tom Vaughan Lawler, Love Hate, The Avengers, Niamh McCann, Brooklyn, Ina Hardwick, Vivarium, Alex Murphy with us, The Young Offenders, and Claire Barrett from multitudinous efforts around the place. How did you persuade, and I know this is the job of a producer, a good producer, to persuade, but how did you actually just say, will you come and do this podcast for me, lads? I presume you didn't have millions of pounds in your back pocket that you could tempt them with.
We certainly did not have millions of pounds, I can tell you that much for free. I was very fortunate. I went to the Lear, and so Paul would have been the year above me and Alex the year behind, and a lot of other very talented actors whose names, if you don't know now, you will know in a couple of years. Alexandra Conlon and Kyle Hixon and Martha Breen and Niamh McAllister and lots of other people. So I suppose I basically what I did is I tried to write the best scripts that I could, and we pitched people the idea. And we were very fortunate with the people that we got, and people were very kind to come on board. So I'm not entirely sure I can answer why they all decided to do it, to be perfectly honest.
Alex Murphy, why did you come on board?
Well, he's right in saying there was no money, but that's okay. Well, yeah, you don't. It's not often you get someone as just nice as Fiontán writing something that good. And you know he can talk for Ireland in the best way. So we went for lunch and he pitched the idea and I was like, yeah, of course I'm in. These are great people and happy to do it. Yeah. It was so long ago now. It was well over a year we recorded it. So I kind of forgot it was being released until recently.
Yeah. Who paid for the lunch?
I think we paid for our own separate lunches. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Claire Barrett, now, were you invited to lunch, Claire? And if you weren't, is your nose going to be?
I wasn't. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be looking for that lunch now. Back again. No, but I got a very nice email, and I remember reading it at the time, going, God, if everybody gets an email like this, you know what I mean? That strokes your ego to such a degree. Like, why wouldn't you say yes? Now, to be fair, Fiontán is a very lovely man. Who? Why wouldn't you get involved? It was a great project. Like, and I don't know if you're like me and a lot of the world at the moment interested in all these podcasts that are murder related or the creep dive or those kind of things. It's nice to get to do a dramatic version of those, like, you know, and there's not as much radio drama being done on podcast series. So it was a lovely thing to be part of.
Yeah, I was wondering about that from the very outside, Fiontán. Did you have this idea that it was actually, I mean, essentially we're talking, it's exactly the tools that you would use if you were making a radio drama, except that you're putting it out there on the podcast platform rather than on a traditional FM radio station. Was it important to you, or was that aspect of things, that it was going to be a radio style play, was that important?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess my first show we did in the Dublin Fringe Festival, and then brought it back to the Beckett, and then we produced it. It was a musical called Beat. So we produced it then as an album, and suddenly we went from, you know, you can't beat live theatre, but at the same time we went from audiences of, you know, a couple hundred people a night to 35,000 listens and streams on Spotify, and we realised the audience you could reach. So I'd written one play, which is Co-Tenant, the all-female crime thriller, which is coming out in 4 weeks' time, as a stage play. But after that, all of the ones that I wrote were specifically for the radio and to work on the radio. So the first one that I did with Stuart Shields, which Claire Barrett was in, I wrote it with him. And we wrote it very specifically to work as a radio drama. Mm. And releasing it on Spotify means, you know, pretty much everybody can listen on their phones.
Yeah, and so you have it with you anywhere you go. So that's the episode in which you play your part. The part of Debbie is your character, Claire, in Hiding Trout.
Yeah. Maybe
tell us a little bit about where she, the kind of the basis of the story and where she fits into it all.
Well, the basis of the story is about two chaps that are get involved in something that they shouldn't have. Well, and my part is more that I try to hinder their mechanisms of trying to clean up the mess, in that I'm the mother-in-law and they're at a communion party and I'm more interfering than anything else, worrying by my son-in-law isn't joining in as he should be and partaking in the plan, and I try to interfere in that respect, but all I do is delay the process, I think. But yeah, it's kind of what's very lovely about the two stories, that there's two stories going on. You have the guys who work in the garage, and then you have the separate issue of the underhanded or the crime world going on. And then when the two worlds collide, that's when we get all the madcap eccentricities that happen.
Yeah, Is Peter Coonan your son or your son-in-law now?
He's my son-in-law. My son-in-law. He's married to Alex Conlon, who's my daughter now, who I reared to be better, but I don't know that either of them are involved in such terrible things going on, all under the auspices of my granddaughter's communion. So all I want is for it to pass off peacefully.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip that gives us a sense of what you would be like as an interfering mother-in-law, Claire.
You haven't got a drink, Shannon.
No, I'm not actually.
You're not drinking, are you not?
No, got the wheels.
But you're only round the corner, Shannon, making the rest of us feel awkward.
Well, I'm sorry, Debbie, I didn't mean to offend you.
Oh, no need to apologise, there's no skin off my nose. I'm just thinking about Siobhan. She's gone to a lot of trouble for you to have a good time, Shannon.
I know.
And it's a bit of a slap in the face, isn't it? In here, not drinking.
Well, I don't think I'm in.
And not talking. Sure, we all might as well have stayed in the office, mightn't we?
Yeah, Debbie.
Will I fetch you a Moroni, Shannon?
No, Debbie, I'm fine for a drink. Thank you.
What are you doing in here?
I was just acting as Shannon's secretary for a few business calls.
Thanks, ma'am. What are you doing in here, Shannon?
He hasn't even taken a drink, Mel.
I can see that, ma'am.
Too busy, I suppose.
I've got the car here, Debbie.
We're only around the corner, Shan.
That's right, Shannon. You're only around the corner. This is basically just an extension of your home office.
Thanks, Debbie.
Shall I fetch you a Moroni?
No, thanks, Debbie.
Get him a Moroni, man.
Your wish is my command, Shannon.
No, Debbie. That's all right. I'm all right for a Moroni. Thank you.
And that's Peter Coonan there as the wonderfully named Shannon. He gets an awful lot of stick about that name in the episode, it must be said. And Alex Conlon, we heard in there just at the end of the season, I think, as Mel, and yourself, Claire Barrett, as Debbie, being very helpful, of course.
Helpful there, yes. Yeah, yeah, that's helpful inverted commas there, yeah. Sean.
nice kind of passive-aggressive.
Passive-aggressive, yes. I was bringing it all out there. God help any future children.
So, Alex, in terms of the episode that's coming up then, Thunder, is the episode that you're involved in. Again, we're in a pretty nasty world with these guys, a bundle of men, really. Gangsters, yeah. It has to be said. It's a pretty nasty world, but it has a similar quality in some ways to what we got in Hiding Trout, which was that first episode.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a madcap aspect to it as well.
Yeah, no, it's quite... Reservoir Dogs is what came to mind whenever I was reading it first. And Fintan and Isaac made a great score for this episode, and it really adds to the tension of it all. It's essentially a load of robbers in a den after... a heist which unravels throughout the piece, but it was amazing when we were doing it. It was very bizarre because it was that Thursday when COVID hit Ireland. It was very odd. We were in Fintan's front room recording it, all of us, and we were just listening to the news bit by bit, and we were like, should we go home to our families? Is this the end of the world? We didn't really know. That was the last thing I did for a long time. but it was good fun. And if anything else, just listen to it for Andrew Bennett being a very scary man.
Andrew's very scary in it, it has to be said. No, I was just wondering though how much method acting was involved for you, Alex, when it came to being your character. He wouldn't be the best teller of a joke or a story, would he?
No. And it depends on who you ask. Maybe I'm not.
I'll need to cut in here and say it takes a very good joke teller to tell a joke badly on purpose. So that's definitely definitely something that we went for with Alex.
You're absolutely right. It's like singing out of tune. To do it out of tune properly is much harder than to do it in tune properly.
Exactly. But on top of like the podcast is somehow very gruesome and you can there's no visuals. So I was listening to it driving and I was just tough listen at times. But it's also there's songs in it. Paul sings a great song and Frank Blake. So there's a bit of a musical aspect throughout it as well.
Yeah, we'll finish up with Paul Mescal's song. But before I go there, I have to make it clear that this is you. What's the character's name, your character's name, Alex, in this?
Weasel.
Weasel, that's it, yeah. Weasel is not the best teller of a story, but Alex Murphy is very good at not being the best teller of a story. So let's listen to him tell us a joke.
Weasel, have you got a story for us?
I've got a... Oh, well, no. Not a story, but it's a sort of joke. This lad, he goes out to his barber's, see, and like the barber says, what sort of cut do you want? And your man says, I would... No, the barber says to your man, how would you like your hair, not your hair, he didn't say hair in the sentence, he said, how would you like it done? And what cut do you want and how would you like it done? That's what the barber said to your man. And also the barber's is next to a steakhouse, that's important. So they do steaks and hot dogs and smoothies and that sort of thing. So he says to your man, his name's Killian or Jack or, I don't know, Pork or something, what cut do you want and how do you want it done? And so your man, Joe or whatever, says, T-bone, please. Medium rare. Because they thought they did steak. Fuck's sake, I thought that was a good one, lads.
I love the tumbleweed at the very end there. That's Alex Murphy as Weasel in that scene from... That episode is called Thunder, isn't it? Yeah, that's the episode that'll be coming out. It features Paul Mescal as well. But I want to finish up with the Paul Mescal aspect of it. Was this actually recorded then just a little bit ahead of normal people hitting the screens and Paul rising to the stardom that he now has risen to in recent months?
It was indeed, yeah. I mean, I'd be lying if I said there wasn't some tactics involved, because he had shot Normal People at that stage and he was in a play with Alex. And I thought, if I can write something and, of course, cast myself in it with these guys, that'll be the best thing for my career. So I wrote myself this huge monologue. And, of course, when we got to the edit, that was the first thing that had to be cut because it made no sense in the context of the story.
But you can say, well, of course, I've acted with the BAFTA-winning Paul Mescal.
And all of the actors in it are absolutely fantastic. Yeah. We got our dream cast.
And tell me briefly then, I want to hear a little bit of the song from Paul. Did you know about the singing talent before you cast him and before you did this piece?
I did, yeah. I've been at many rowdy after sessions where we've all sung and we've done lots of singing nights in the Lear as well. So I'd heard Paul. I knew he was a brilliant singer.
Right. Well, listen, thanks to the three of you for being with us this evening, Alex Murphy, Claire Barrett and Fiona and Larney. And we'll finish with Paul Mescal and the song that he sings in that episode coming up, Thunder.
There's a place near the Laggan where the thorns and the bracken are the yawning mouth of a cave. Inside you will find him, with no one to mind him. He's lying alone in his grave. And when the bank floods, you can still smell the blood, and the water runs black to the bed. Oh, the howls and the shivers, the hushed breaths and whispers, the secrets we keep in our head.
Yeah, so he can sing as well. That's another talent that he has, string to his bow. Paul Mescal there, and Black to Bed is the song that you'll hear. That's part of Thunder. The first episode of Black Alley is available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. The new one, a fortnightly edition of the show, the new one will be available through until July the 13th. And I meant to compliment Alex Murphy on his fine Nordy accent there as well. Fiona Larney, Alex Murphy and Claire Barrett speaking to us this evening.
At Woodies, we know longer days mean getting the garden summer ready. That's why we've got great value on everything from plants to patio sets, along with tasty deals on barbecues too. Because it's more than a garden, it's making the most of summer. Now, for less. Woodies, we're all homemakers.
You know what? Whoever said that nothing in life is free is wrong. My mate,
One Leg Larry got a free ticket to a crocodile enclosure last year. Although, up until that point, we just call him Larry. It's probably a bad example, but what about your PRSI entitlement at Specsavers? That gives you a free eye test and free glasses from their €69 range.
And now, get free hearing aids with PRSI too. Book an appointment or find out more at specsavers.ie.
If you're aged 40 to 44, you'll be offered your free COVID-19 vaccine next. You can register now on hse.ie. When it's time for your vaccine, we'll send you a text with your appointment time and location. You'll be invited to get your vaccine at a HSE vaccination centre. If you can't register online, you can call us on 1850 24 1850. To register or to find out more about your COVID-19 vaccine, go to hse.ie. From the HSE.
The new Dunstores app puts better value at your fingertips. Scroll your way through this week's Burger Bar savings. Enjoy our Borbia approved Irish beef ribsteak 5-ounce burgers 2-pack for €3 and our fresh Irish chicken burgers 4-pack are €3.50. Or try our vegan beetroot burgers 2-pack for €2.50. Download the app today and receive a one-time 10 off 30 welcome voucher. Dunstores, always better value. Terms and conditions apply. Welcome voucher can be used in next grocery shop for €30 or more.
And so to our albums on this Friday evening. First up will be Garbage, a Scottish-American band formed by the legendary producer Butch Vig. Huge success with their 1995 self-titled album tonight. They give us album number 7, which is called No Gods, No Masters. After that, we'll have the Welsh-born with the Greek father, Marina Lambrine Diamandis. Welsh singer, musician, songwriter and producer, professionally known simply as Marina. Fifth album, Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land, is what we have this evening. And West Coast American duo, now duo, Slater Kinney, comprising Carrie Brownstein and Corin Tucker, bring us album number 10 since their formation in 1994. Pass of Wellness is the title there. Louise Bruton and Simon Marr have been listening. We'll start with Garbage. No Gods, No Masters is the new album, and this is the title track. No Gods, No Masters, the title of that track from the album of the same title from Garbage, the first of our three up for review this evening, Simon Marr and Louise Bruton. Louise, I mentioned Butch Vig, but of course we have to talk about Shirley Manson and band members Duke Erickson and Steve Marker. What would you say they do, particularly, I suppose, it's Shirley Manson that gives this band its particular flavour?
I suppose I would think when you think of Garbage, you immediately think of Shirley Manson, who is this kind of fiery, iconic front woman. And there was something quite political about Shirley being a front woman of a big band like Garbage in the 90s, because there weren't that many women kind of being as ferocious as she was. And they have definitely kind of held on to a cult status throughout, but they've never really, their legacy hasn't really doubled in the way that it should have as all of their anniversaries roll around. Like I think they're going through many 20-year anniversaries of all of their early albums. But they have devout fans who stuck through the good, the bad and the ugly. And I think this is somewhere between good and bad, this album. Because there is one thing that you have to kind of swallow with this album is they're loaded. And this whole album is an anti-establishment record. And there's one thing that kind of, when I was reading their bio, they recorded most of this in the Palm Springs home of the guitarist Steve Marker. So as they're singing about the 1%, it's kind of hard to stomach that they are to the 1%.
They're not struggling to sing about the 1%. In those terms, Simon, then, the track we just heard, No Gods, No Masters, how representative is that of the album? And in fact, how representative is it of Garbage's sound in general?
Well, there's always been, I suppose, with most Garbage records over the years, they're always kind of divided into two. They were divided into the personal and then the political. And that's kind of been the same since, as Louisa, like when you go back to the 1995 when they released their first album. And this album, it definitely is no different. There's a number of tracks are, I suppose, reflective of the times that we're in now. So there's a lot of talk of, you know, you mentioned the 1%, you know, of misogyny, of gender disparity, all of that stuff that's been going on. And then on the other side of it, you know, there's the tracks where I suppose Manson reveals something that bit more personal, and probably ironically enough is that probably the personal stuff is just feels that bit more real than perhaps some of the politics does.
And would you put Waiting for God in that personal side of what she's discussing here?
Well, yeah, like there's it's funny that there's three or four, and this album, as so many albums do nowadays, goes on far, far too long for its own good. But there are certain tracks in here that you kind of think it's almost as if there's a breath has been taken and now it's going to be something else. The album is going to be something else. And when it gets to be that something else, and on tracks like that, and on some of the other tracks that where she talks more personally, it becomes more than just, well, I suppose we call it a regular Garbage album.
Right, well, let's listen to a little bit of Waiting for God then.
Waiting for God to show up. We're keeping our fingers crossed. Can't seem to make sense of all of this madness. Waiting for God to show up. Look what they did to a boy, and nobody's blinking an eye. She's choking on sadness with no hope for justice. Just look what they did to her boy.
Waiting for God, the title of that track from Garbage and No Gods, No Masters. As Simon was saying, Louise, a little bit more in that track, although I think you were saying to me as we were listening, lyrics not so hot.
Well, that track in particular, that would be one of the stronger ones because it deals specifically with the Black Lives Matter movement, and it does that clever thing of highlighting an awareness of what's going on in the world while also addressing white privilege, which I think a lot of acts kind of currently don't really own up to their own fault in that if they are a white person. But there is something in Shirley's delivery saves a lot of the bad lyrics, and there is something quite harder in their delivery and their sound. There is kind of like an electro rock soundscape that is quite harsh that I don't think that we're getting a lot with mainstream rock acts. So it is quite refreshing
when it comes. Sense. Stars from you, first of all, Louise.
Three and a half
from you. And what are you saying overall, Simon?
Yeah, I've always been a big Garbage fan. I lost them completely. So by the time you get into Bleed Like Me and stuff in the mid-2000s. But I did kind of come back to them for this. And I think there's more than enough good bits on this to make this worth a listen. So yeah, Louise is right. 3.5.
3.5 from both of you. So even Stevens for Garbage and No Gods, No Masters. Let's move on then to latest release from Marina, not formerly known as Marina and the Diamonds. Fifth album is called Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land out today. And let's have a listen to, again, we'll have a listen to the title track, why don't we?
I can back to a time before
Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land, opening and title track from the new album from Marina. Louise, the voice is one of the things that you hear immediately, the quality and the versatility, even across a minute or two on that track there. But she lays out the stall with that opening track. This is what you're going to get. It's upbeat for the most part throughout the 10 tracks of this album.
Yeah, Marina, I'm still stuck in the mind of calling her Marina the Diamonds, but she is to the full front. She's a proper performer. And a problem that Marina's always had from the start of her career is that she's not quite sure which formula it is that she fits into. So when she started out in 2010, she was sort of the anti-pop pop star. Mm. And then she swung into properly being the bubblegum pop star. And again, she's just not quite happy with where she sits in her place. So this music, her last album and this album, is all about looking at the world, looking bigger than herself. So like one track, Man's World, it takes on misogyny, but it also takes on ecofeminism and climate change. So she's trying to be a smarter pop star, but a lot of the time all of her references get kind of clogged up in the song, and it can be a bit busy at times.
And there's a kind of a brashness, Simon, and a confidence in what she does. Is that refreshing or does it become grating after a while?
I really do think it's a good thing. And even when I was thinking about it, when I was listening to the album, I was thinking about, you know, pop music can be so often like golf. It's a real confidence game. And, you know, it really is one of those things that you really have to feel very, very comfortable with what you're doing. And at least at this stage, by the time this album has come around, it sounds like she's very confident about what she's doing. And for the first four tracks of the album, it is just literally hurled at you. And it almost comes as a shock then when you get to track five and suddenly it slows down and suddenly, you know, the force comes off it a bit and you feel that she has a need that she has to be constantly on and constantly performing. Whereas perhaps actually when it's toned back a little bit, some of the songs are very good and her voice is amazing.
Let's have a listen to a track a little bit further down the track listing then. I Love You, But I Love Me More.
I love you, but I love me more. Don't come back knocking out my door. You've had your chance and now you want more. You say you'll change, you say you'll transform. Do you expect me to believe that you've changed when I can tell that you're exactly the same? You rather shut your eyes and feel any pain. Told myself I can go back ever again.
I Love You, But I Love Me More from Marina and the album Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land. She has a background, or an early background at any rate, Louise, you were saying, in music theatre, and you can hear that in the kind of range across her vocal ability.
Yeah, the pop star of Marina began when she was rejected to perform on the West End in The Lion King. So we've a lot to... Simba and co. But the thing with the album is it's an album of two halves, and it's... when she's performing so much on the first half, it's so busy. But the second half is all about a breakup. She used to go out with one of the members of Clean Bandits. So the second half of the album is all about the heartbreak and picking up the pieces and putting yourself together as a person again. So the second half is the stronger half of the album when you have more personal songs like the one we just heard there.
Yeah.
And Flowers and Goodbye, they're the final two songs. Because when you just have her vocals, which are incredible, she goes so low and so high to express so many emotions. And when she just uses the piano, it just makes a point clearer rather than trying to be kind of the moment.
Yeah, those final two songs that you mentioned certainly were the best on the album for me. And only 10 tracks, she has the good sense to keep it short, swift and to the point. Starts from you first in your summary, Simon.
Yeah, no, I do. You know, I think you're absolutely right. I think it is. It's definitely the album of two halves, and that second half. And it's funny because it's since album number one and right the way up to now, it's when you get those more personal moments from Marina is that she becomes somebody who is way above the sort of the general, you know, pop quota that's in there. So I'm going to give this 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5 from you, Louise.
Yeah, I'm going to go with 3 as well. I think the next album will be the one that she will, is the one that we deserve to hear.
Right, you're waiting for, is it album number 8 then from her, the next one? I think it is. So that's, it's album number 6 next time. Thank you for that. Marina, Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land is the second album that we'll be speaking about this evening. Final album from Slater Kinney, Path of Wellness. Going to listen to a track, first of all, called Worry With You, and be warned, a little bit of language in the midst of this track. Worry With You, the title of that track from Slater Kinney and the new album Path of Wellness. Slater Kinney were a trio for a long time, Louise, but now essentially a duo?
Essentially a duo, yeah. On their last album, which was released in 2019, which was the St. Vincent produced The Centre Won't Hold, which was actually a brilliant record, the drummer Janet Weiss left that immediately after the album was wrapped up. So this is their first album as a duo. It's also the first album that they self-produced, and when you listen through it, that third extra set of ears and eyes is probably what needs to drive their album across the line, because this one, there's one thing I actually kept thinking when I was listening to this was, with their last record, they kept saying how important it was to see women in their 40s in rock music. And when I listened to this album, I realised, they're joining the likes of Foo Fighters and Weezer, who are men in their 40s making middle-of-the-road rock music. So they've now joined that fun club.
Yeah, middle-of-the-road is not a great place to be. Were you worried about them getting run over where they were with their music in the middle of the road, Simon?
Do you know, again, they're a band that I've always enjoyed, but they're a band that I've always divided, and I've always wanted to divide their fans, and they do it almost album by album. Mm. And between the last album, which I agree was a great album, and this, they will have done it again. And it's one of those, I'm listening through it, and I really wanted to like it an awful lot more than I did. But something that's interesting about the band is that I probably won't listen to Path to Wellness again, but when the next album comes out, you know they will doubtless have reinvented themselves by then, and hopefully they will have stood away from the middle of the road.
Path of Wellness, I thought I was going to get a kind of easy listening ambience type of thing given that title. Is there anything in any of the songs, Louise, that goes towards that kind of more healing suggested in the title?
Well, that's the thing. So this album was recorded during COVID, as most albums have been released now.
Yeah.
So that's not an excuse for the low quality barrier here. But Worry With You is a song about escape. So, that's as deep as it goes. And it is a pity, because they are a band that were at the forefront of the Riot Girl kind of movement. And when they had the chance to be political on this album, they took low swings on one song called The Complex Female Characters, which is a kind of a slow and sleazy blues song. And they sing from the perspective of male chauvinist. And it just, I feel like they're just too advanced for what this is.
Right. OK, let's have a listen to a track called Bring Mercy, just a final sample from the album. Just wanted to get a sense of that that track Bring Mercy from Slater Kinney and the new album Path of Wellness. What are you saying overall, Simon, in 10 seconds and your stars, please?
I'm saying give Janet Weiss a call, ask her to come back for the next album, and it's 2.5.
And what are you saying, Louise?
Lesser 2.
Letter two. All right. That's Sleater-Kinney, Path of Wellness, Marina, Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land, and Garbage, No Gods, No Masters, the three albums that Simon Marr and Louise Bruton were talking about this evening. And that is our lot for this Friday evening here on Arena. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Tommy O'Sullivan. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will talk to you once again Monday night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. Right now, time for John Creedon.